The floor is yours, Mr. Hooker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the Council. I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and give you an update on BOEM's offshore renewable energy program, primarily focusing on the status of the New York wind energy area. I think we had promised after the issuance of the revised environmental assessment and the lease sale for New York that we come in and give you an opportunity to give myself an opportunity to give you an update on where we are in the next steps, and it'll be an opportunity for questions and comment. So a quick outline for today. I want to give you a brief overview of the changes to the New York wind energy area environmental assessment, changes to the actual lease itself, the results of the lease auction, the lease execution and milestones, and then also a status of oil and gas activities on the Atlantic. And finally, an update on BOEM's environmental studies program. So the primary changes to the environmental assessment, so we had an environmental assessment, and then we had notice and comment, and then based on that notice and comment, we had made some revisions to the EA before issuing the finding of no significant impact. So we did remove five aliquots, which is about 1,780 acres, from lease consideration. I'll get to a map in a minute. And that was based upon sensitive fish habitat concerns raised by the National Marine Fisheries Service as part of our consultation and for essential fish habitat. That reduced the total fisheries exposure revenue-wise by approximately 7%. We also updated the NIMS fisheries revenue data for the wind energy area through 2015 and added a whole new Appendix G to talk to more fully flesh out all the different data we had on fisheries use of the area. And again, so it's a whole new appendix at the end of the EA. So what we have here is the original wind energy area with a white outline. And what we removed is the area in the white outline. What you can see is cholera bank that extends down. It's around the 30-meter contour line. There's some variation in depth around that bank, and so we removed any overlap with that bank. Again, this was primarily due to NIMS' recommendation that putting a site assessment structure such as a met tower or a buoy in that area could have some impacts to essential fish habitat. So what we have on this slide, this is the, just to refresh everyone's memory, the data set that we're using for our fisheries revenue exposure is the same data set from the Northeast Fisheries Science Center that's used in several FMPs, I think most recently Amendment 16 to the squid, mackerel, butterfish, and evaluating the canyon closures. This is that same revenue data set. And again, this is just showing you the area of the wind energy area, other wind energy areas, and the exposure, the fisheries exposure for that area. And you can also see on the inset some of the other fisheries features from the New Jersey Fishing Atlas as well. So this graph is showing you the FMP. Well, actually, the first on the far left is all trawl gear exposure to the New York wind energy area. And this is the revised area compared to the original area. So just to orient you there, the original area is the red and the revised area is in blue. And also, so we did it for all trawl gear and then again for the squid mac FMP, as well as Atlantic Sea Scallop FMP, and then all fisheries combined. As you can see, Atlantic Sea Scallop, very high revenue fishery, so they kind of overwhelm that revenue bar. So here we, in a lot of comments on the EA, we've got a lot of feedback on the averaging out of the data over the years. That it swamps the true highs of the fishery use in that area. So in Appendix G, as I mentioned, we broke it out by year, so you can So it's not just an averaged amount that appears in the EA. And so here again is the use of the area by the scallop fishery, by total value, and then by percent of total catch. So you can see in, was that 2011, I think it is, there was the highest peak, and I think that was, looks like it was associated around the time of the Hudson Canyon closure, and a lot of general category scallop vessels might have shifted some effort inshore as a result of that. But it's unclear to me exactly, but that's one possibility for that. And again, the fisheries revenue is meant to be just a guidepost for us to get a general sense of the level of activity that's occurring in that area. So regarding specific changes to the New York lease, we added an addendum C to the lease. This is the actual lease that will be issued to the lessee, that they have to hire a fisheries liaison. Previously, we had guidance to developers regarding the use of a fisheries liaison and the need to hire them. We still have that guidance, and it goes into a lot of detail in the roles and responsibility of that. That guidance document was informed in large part by best management practices workshop we held up and down the coast, and actually a workshop held by the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council. But anyway, we decided in this particular case it was important to show the commitment of the need for a fisheries communication plan and hiring a fishery liaison, so we embedded it actually into the lease. So on December 16th, we actually held the lease sale. Statoil Wind U.S. was declared the provisional winner of the New York lease auction with a winning bid of $42,469,725. This is the highest award or the highest auction value that we have received for any of our renewable energy auctions to date. On December 30th, 2016, the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice completed their antitrust review, and the next step is to sign, execute the lease. So as of right now, the lease has not been executed for Statoil. They are still in this provisional winner category. So the lease milestone schedule, depending on when the lease is actually executed, they have a one-year preliminary term to get their stuff together. The next term is what we call the site assessment term. That's the term for which we did the environmental assessment. So that's the placement of a meteorological tower or meteorological buoy in the lease area to do a wind resource assessment. During that five-year period, they also will do geophysical and geotechnical surveys to evaluate the seabed for eventual design of a offshore wind facility. So after that five-year term, there's the operations term. That's when they begin their construction and operations, and at the end of the five-year term is when the end of the site assessment term is when we would receive a construction and operations plan as well, and that would then instigate the 25-year operational term of the lease. We also have a requirement in there that 90 days prior to conducting surveys in the lease area, the lessee must submit a survey plan to BOEM. Again, this is just, I put this in there just to make it clear that before they're even on the water, there's plans that have to be submitted for us to review and evaluate, and also there would be an opportunity there before they even get on the water to coordinate with the hire a fishery liaison and develop that fisheries communication plan before activities on the water. I was asked also to give you an update on the status of the oil and gas program in the Atlantic. If you recall, I think at one point the South Atlantic had been included in the draft proposed program. However, on November 18th, 2016, BOEM published the final program governing oil and gas lease sales for 2017 to 2022. This is also called the five-year plan. And no Atlantic lease sales in the North Atlantic or South Atlantic were approved. On December 20th, 2016, the president used authorities under OXLA and that would be President Obama, used authorities under OXLA Section 12A to withdraw from disposition 31 Atlantic Canyons from oil and gas leasing indefinitely. And then following that, on January 6, 2017, BOEM denied six pending Atlantic oil and gas geophysical and geological survey permits. So I think at one point that when back in November 2016, there was a question still around were the permits still going to be issued to allow the seismic surveys to continue, even though the five-year plan didn't have any Atlantic lease sales. But in January, BOEM denied those permits. So the pending permits are now denied. Of course, they can reapply at any future date for those seismic survey permits. So this is a little hard to see. What I tried to do is show with the Atlantic Canyon withdrawal areas from future oil and gas development, overlaid with both the Mid-Atlantic Canyon closure, Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council closure areas, and the draft areas that you have proposed, I think, in the EFH Omnibus Amendment. As you can see, they closely align. The outlines are the council closure areas, and the blocks are the BOEM withdrawal areas. So they're basically the overlay those areas exactly. So lastly, that first bullet's a little old. The 2017-2019 studies development plan has been posted. That was posted a little while ago. We're now in the process of doing the 2018-2020 studies development plan. One of the studies that is still, it's pretty much completed, but there's still some final revisions going on, is that socioeconomic impact of the Outer Continental Shelf. That's the final report that has all of that fisheries revenue data kind of described by wind energy area in it, and also an impact analysis associated with it as well. All the data for that has been posted on our website for quite some time. As I said, the data is available from the Northeast Fisheries Science Center as far as the exposure data is concerned as well, the underlying raster data set. Ongoing, we're still doing the electromagnetic fields on elasmobranchs and lobster movement. This was on the Cross Island Sound cable in Long Island Sound with URI. That's pretty much wrapped up, and we're in the final report writing phase of that now. The fishery habitat surveys that we contracted with the Northeast Fishery Science Center at the Howard Lab is ongoing. Most of the wind injuries have been completed. We're just pretty much in the report writing phase for that as well. The report for the Maryland wind energy area is available on our website. We just kicked off this past year. I'm very excited about a lot of new fish telemetry work in the Mid-Atlantic, starting with New York, Delaware, and Maryland. And we already have an existing fish telemetry work offshore Virginia. So this is really the first offshore fish telemetry work that has been done, really trying to understand sturgeon overwintering habitat usage, but as well as picking up all kinds of other tagged, acoustically tagged fish as well. And we want to also tag some of our own species, such as black sea bass, that may have some site fidelity to the areas and wanting to know their movements as well. BOEM has also published guidelines to developers on pre-construction benthic habitat surveys, pre-construction fishery surveys, and as I mentioned earlier, the communication with commercial and recreational fisheries. The next step then is obviously to develop post-construction monitoring guidelines. And I'm happy to say as of this morning, we have awarded a contract to the National Academies of Science to specifically look at fisheries research program and helping us to develop post-construction monitoring protocols. So we'll probably be hearing more about that as we get closer to actually having a workshop on that, hopefully. Before the end of the year. So here we go. I just wanted to show you quickly where some of these sites were. So this is the Navy acoustic telemetry array in blue, and then we tied into that array in red, going through the Virginia wind energy area, and also did some put some receivers in a sand shoal borrow area off of Sandbridge. Here's the array layout for the New York wind energy area. This is the Delaware wind energy area layout. And lastly, the Maryland wind energy area layout. Again, for all the, these are the primary VIMCO, VIMCO receivers that have been deployed. So for future fishery studies and kickoff for FY17, so I'm actively these are actively ongoing right now, is understanding fish auditory thresholds and masking. We'll be working with the Northeast Fishery Science Center, Howard Lab again. They have an excellent tank that we can do a lot of these studies in. We hope to utilize that. Also, we hope to move forward with the a third year of the Southern New England lobster movements. This was a ventless trap survey. We hope to extend that with some additional tagging work as well. The rodeo project is still ongoing. This is doing the conducting observations pre-construction and post-construction at the Deepwater Block Island Wind Facility site. And then for FY18 planning, as I mentioned, we received several environmental studies proposals, ideas for FY18 that I am actively considering as well. Some really, really good ideas on future fisheries work that I hope to bring and discuss in the kind of the forum of the National Academies that I mentioned earlier that was awarded this morning. So that's really all from me, but I'm definitely happy to open up to questions and do my best to answer them.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Hooker. We'll open up the questions from the council first. Mr. Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is anecdotal, I know, but I heard some complaints about the herring in southern New England acting funny as soon as you guys fired up the cables. Have you talked to any fishing people about that? And things aren't settling down like they used to? And have you had some complaints, or is that just somebody complaining to me?
I haven't heard. We do have some permitting authority on the cable between Block Island and the mainland because it does travel through federal waters, but I haven't heard anything firsthand on the cable.
Mr. Gibson.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. I have a question on the fishing vessel, the revenue calculations, and in discussions with staff at home, I think they've come to the conclusion that they're underestimated because of the, and they may have contacted you with comments on this, about the limited data set being used. My understanding that's a vessel trip report system or data set which doesn't necessarily provide real fine scale data, and I think they have been using the DMIS, the data matching imputation system, which I think, as I understand it, blends VMS data, VTR, observer reports, and things like that to get much finer scale resolution of where fishing takes place and what these revenues are. I wonder if you could comment on that as to whether those comments have been taken into account and these calculations updated.
Thank you, Mark. Definitely we got the letter from your staff, and we do plan on having a teleconference scheduled with them, I believe, next week. To learn more about the methodology they used. What we presented today does not use that methodology that they had proposed, but we're definitely interested in learning more about it, and if we can make it work, we'll use it, and if it's more accurate, we're open to doing that. So that's scheduled for, I believe, next week or the week after. So, I mean, different fisheries, I think, I think it's hard, as you mentioned, with some of the small spatial scales and understanding how to allocate part of a trip that crosses a wind energy area. Do you allocate that entire trip to the wind energy area, or is it a partial allocation? And I think that's where some of it is, because especially in that narrow band in the far west, you have trips that traverse the entire wind energy area, and that allocation part and how that works in the math is, I think, where a lot of the discrepancy occurs. So even in Appendix G, we did try to bound the exposure by also including the revenue from the entire statistical area. So if you go back to, I think I have the, okay, yeah. This one has the statistical areas on there. You can see the light gray line. That statistical area 612 encompasses that entire wind energy area. So we did bound it in the EA. We put that in there that, okay, this is what the revenue calculations are telling us from the exact slicing of activity in the wind energy area. However, we also recognize that for that entire area 612, here's the data that we have for that as well to try to put kind of a range in there. So, but I definitely am interested in learning more about how we can use the VMS data to really get some of that fine scale movement.
Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Dr. Chairman. As far as revenue goes, I know the industry gave BOEM quite a bit of proprietary information on actual revenue, actual vessel trip reports. And it is my understanding that some of the trip reports were actually much higher value than your total value for that area. So I'm trying to understand where the data that the industry presented to you went, because it appears to me it couldn't have gone anywhere.
Again, we didn't see anything with the specific trip level data that was received that was necessarily inconsistent with the range that we had presented in the EA regarding whether or not we're looking at the exposure revenue table or the entire statistical area. Individual level trips there were some high ones for, but at the same time, we felt that was captured in what we presented in the environmental assessment.
Ms. Tooley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation. On the scallop fishing revenue from the area, obviously this fishery is from Virginia to the Hague Line. It encompasses a large area, so it doesn't surprise me to see the percentages, but I think looking at it in that way doesn't really reflect impact very well. And also, I did hear you mention general category, fishing versus limited access, which I think I was happy to hear that you at least understood that there is a difference. I think breaking down the information like that would be helpful. I think also breaking down the information by home port, because the impacts can be quite different. The general category fishery, small boats, it's 5.5% of the total, so the impacts to them could be much greater. And I think that you have information here, and I'm not questioning whether it's correct or not. I assume that it likely is, but I don't think it really, is to the level of detail that indicates impact. And I think if you could, I believe that we have information that's and data sets that could be helpful at getting you there, and I think that would be more useful for this process.
Thank you very much. And definitely, I mean, this is, once again, just the exposure, trying to describe the level of activity that's occurring in the area. We'll be getting to impact from construction and operations when we conduct our environmental review of a construction and operations plan once one is submitted, just to make that clear. So the feedback we're receiving now, I think, is essential to when that impact analysis is conducted in the future on how that's done, and a lot also depends on what's included in the construction and operations plan when it's submitted and what the design will look like. We're talking to Rhode Island DEM staff about a way using VMS to try to, narrow it down a little bit more. There may be some opportunities with scallop as well, because obviously they're using VMS. So we're looking at it and trying to figure out how to really tease out some of those fine scale differences as best we can.
Dr. Pierce.
Hey, Brian, you mentioned that there was a study undertaken by URI regarding the impact of the electromagnetic fields on elasmobranchs, the sharks and the skates and the rays. The study is almost done, I think you said. When might the study results be available for the public? I'm curious to see if indeed the cables are going to draw sharks, for example.
Sure. I probably have to get back to you on that. I know that Dr. King, John King at URI, did present some preliminary results at our Atlantic Science Forum a couple months ago. So I know he has a lot of the preliminary data worked up, but I don't recall what the actual date is that he's, this year. I mean, it's not a long time. So within the next 3 to 6 months, I would imagine, to do that.
Thank you. And clearly, the recreational fishermen and commercial fishermen have been concerned about their access to areas where the turbines are set. How far along are you? How far along is BOEM with discussions regarding access of recreational and commercial fishermen to the structures within the wind energy facilities?
Well, I really think the Block Island Wind Facility is an example of what would occur in the offshore environment, where there is no restrictions at all, even in a full commercial scale project. Obviously, the navigational risk assessment must be done by the lessee as part of their construction and operations plan that goes to the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard has stated that they don't intend to add any restrictions on the outer continental shelf around the turbines. Again, just the only thing that I think you're prohibited from doing on Block Island is tying up to the structures and somehow impeding vessels that are trying to service the platforms. But that really is an example of what we expect to see offshore as well.
Okay. Are any studies underway or being planned regarding the use of these facilities by recreational fishermen, for hire vessels specifically? It's always been said that they'll attract fish, these facilities, therefore they'll attract for hire fishermen. So I'm very curious about that in terms of what might be the eventual impact of these facilities on fish attracting and then maybe benefiting for hire fisheries. So any studies underway or being planned regarding that?
Not at the moment, at least from BOEM's side. The state of Rhode Island maybe had some thoughts on that. But anecdotally, we do see, in visits to Block Island Wind Facility, we do see recreational and charterhead boats in the vicinity of the turbines. But I don't believe at this time I'm aware of any study trying to really look at the change in their use of the area.
Mr. Papalotto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the letter that this council transmitted on this, obviously the issue of exclusion is a concern. Dr. Pierce sort of raised that issue just now. I note the lease, the winning bid at the auction was $42 million. The next step is to sign and execute, and then you laid out the step after that and the step after that. Preliminary term, site assessment, operational term for 25 years. So assuming it all rolls forward and moves forward, that's around $1.7 million a year for the rights to that area for this purpose.
Well, there's the auction bid, and then there's also rent payments, and then there's also royalty payments. And depending on what they build, depends on what the royalty payments would be and the amount of energy that's produced by the facility. I don't recall offhand what the rent payments are, but I don't know if you added that into what your calculation was. But so if you were trying to value that seabed based upon that, you'd have to factor all three of those types of payments in.
Well, that's helpful. No, my calculation was strictly...
Oh, the sale, okay.
The winning bid divided by 25. And then the next thing I did is I said, well, let me see what other information is here. And I went and looked at the scallop revenues out of that area. And taking a conservative approach, and I didn't add it all up and divide it all. So, but it looks to me like a conservative impact, if exclusion were to occur for this one fishery, would be $2 million a year, 2.2, something like that. So that leads me to my question. Where along this process is there opportunities for mitigation or compensation for displacement for the fisheries?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, once the lease is executed and we have Statoil on board, I think that's an excellent conversation to begin having with Statoil. Ultimately, it depends on what the potential impacts are, what they actually plan on building in that area. That's, you know, part of the issue in our with the process is that we don't know what the actual lessee plans on building and what the energy requirements, who they plan to sell to, will be. We know New York is interested in buying offshore wind. But how, after they do the seabed, after they evaluate the seabed and look at what's out there, you know, the amount of area occupied by the facility, either by structures or cables, you know, will be likely less than the entire facility. So, bottom line, the biggest piece is obviously during the construction operations plan, when we do that NEPA analysis, likely an environmental impact statement. We'll have scoping and a full robust analysis and public meetings associated with that. However, prior to that, via the fisheries communication plan requirement and the fisheries liaison, there will be communication directly with Statoil and the fisheries communities that are affected. And if that communication is not happening, then we'll need to know about that. But
okay, so it's the industry, the affected parties have the opportunity to negotiate directly with the project applicant.
Correct.
On their own behalf. They wouldn't work through a federal or state agency to compel, or they wouldn't be represented by anyone but themselves.
There are multiple ways in which to do that. I think there's a lot of examples of compensation in the offshore environment, either through direct negotiations or through some type of umbrella group. I think BOEM has we obviously have the ability, if those pathways are not working out, we can step in and as a term and condition on the acceptance of a plan, we can impose additional requirements, whether they be payments or what have you. But it is our hope that most of that can happen directly between the lessee and the fishing community.
Mr. Kendall.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Brian, for the presentation. On your slide 11, I have a couple questions about the oil and gas program. It says that at your bottom bullet that you denied six survey permits for the year. One question is, how often do they renew or reapply for those permits?
That's entirely up to the industry. If they want to apply tomorrow, there's nothing to prohibit that. It's not there's not a necessarily a set window where we would accept permit applications to be submitted. If you recall, there was an EIS conducted for surveys in the Atlantic that is completed, so I think all the environmental work has been completed to allow those. The biological opinion for that, however, is in being reinitiated. So those permits would have to wait until that reinitiated biological opinion is complete. But once the environmental requirements are met and other paperwork is met, then the agency could issue permits.
And then another question is, it says that I have not read the proposed final program on the oil and gas. So could you sum up? It says, it goes through 2022. Does that mean no sites were going to be for sale for oil and gas through 2022? And then what happens after 2022?
So the oil and gas program is a little different in that they actually have in the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act a requirement to do this five-year program. So it's a statutory requirement that every 5 years, BOEM develop a five-year plan. That five-year plan can be revised by an incoming administration if they so desired, but it's on us. But outside any desire to re-examine the existing five-year plan, it's just on a set schedule. Like every 5 years, they'll do it'll be a draft proposed plan and go out for public comment and move forward in that manner. So it's pretty much an ongoing process in our office, is because the EIS takes so long to do. So pretty much as soon as they finish one five-year plan, then the next five-year plan has begun to get contracted and developed. So it won't be long before that process has already started.
Okay, just as a follow-up. So under the program right now, though, there's nothing to stop an oil and lease oil and gas lease from happening in the near future, then, in this five-year term?
In this five-year term, unless the five-year plan is revisited, there is no oil and gas sales on the Atlantic.
Dr. Sissonwine.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. You mentioned a agreement or a contract just issued with the National Academy of Sciences for review. I assume that's actually with the National Research Council, which is a subsidiary. Can you tell us which board is actually going to be undertaking that study? Can the council be provided with the work statement for the study?
Sure, it is under the Ocean Studies Board. As a matter of fact, I did a while back, I kind of gave a presentation to the Ocean Studies Board regarding the idea of what to do in moving forward. And as I said, it was just awarded this morning. We're in the initial planning area, and the idea is that it will be a publicly accessible meeting, and we're going to be identifying fisheries leaders to be a part of that group. So stay tuned. There will be more. I'm happy to provide the statement of work if you'd like. But anyway, you will be hearing more about that award.
Just a follow-up comment on that. The procedure does allow for nominations from interested parties of members of the committee, so this council might want to consider, in fact, making some nominations itself. Thank you.
Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Dr. Chairman. I just have a question about existing surveys. Don't worry, Mr. Hooker, this one's not for you. There is interaction between the industry and the survey vessel south of Martha's Vineyard already, and usually it involves, one boat towing fishing gear one way and the survey vessel towing its gear another way, and then there's a very short conversation about who can go where. So what I want to know is, what is the regulations, who has the right of way in the open ocean towing trawl gear or scallop gear, green over white, fishing at night, all that, and interaction with a survey vessel. Who's got to get out of the way?
Captain Field.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just trying to refresh my memory here quickly on rules of road situation. It would if the survey vessel is restricted in its ability to maneuver, that would certainly give them the hierarchy situation. I don't know, length of gear, sometimes the whatever arrays or towing might restrict the vessel's movement.
Mr. Reed.
If you've got a guy towing trawl gear or scallop gear, I think probably trawl gear is more likely to affect restriction and maneuverability than a survey vessel or other vessels. So to say that the survey vessel is restricted in its maneuverability, I understand that. But I would contend that a trawl vessel is way more restricted in its maneuverability. And so it's only a question of who is more restricted. If that's the guideline, then somebody should let the survey boat that he's got to get out of the way, if that's the case. which I would say that it is.
Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Brian, for your presentation. I'd like to follow along with Mr. Papalardo's comments and say that mitigation is one of my greatest fears, and that I have sat through a number of presentations from a number of other developers in other countries where individual fishermen are the responsible parties to go negotiate with the developers. And, you know, this whole side of the table could be in the summer flounder fishery. We're all impacted. We all go negotiate separately with the developer, and we are all treated differently in the way that they decide that they're going to mitigate us. That is a big concern of mine, because there's no policy going forward. There's no clear path moving forward on how it is that mitigation takes place. Following up on something that Dr. Pierce had mentioned about restrictions, you know, my concerns now are that there's monopole technology out there. There's floating platform technology out there with catenary cables that spread through from, you know, from a number of different various fetch points in the platform that restrict fisheries and fisheries activities in those areas much greater than monopoles would do. And with the technology that's currently out there, you know, has anybody been looking at deep water areas where they could put platforms with this floating technology that's been developed for a number of years now? And with your timeline, technology is only going to continue to improve. Are there areas out in deeper water where fisheries activities don't take place, where we might not even need to have these discussions, where developers could look to create a wind farm or a wind array? Is that a possibility? Because then there would not be any mitigation aspects to a developer siting. And it would be, if we could put them where we don't fish, it'd be a lot better for everybody. Is that a possibility?
Thank you. The short answer is yes. I mean, it's a possibility. Is, you know, with on the outer continental shelf, to the shelf boundaries where we regulate, that there is the opportunity that if either through a task force process, a BOEM-led process for identifying additional areas, and there's a lot of interest in floating technology. There is obviously on the West Coast, it's almost exclusively floating technology that's proposed. It hasn't exactly taken off yet. There's been some proposals, but then they haven't gone forward. So there are a few companies that are active in it. I think over in Asia, some of the Asian countries, they're really putting some prototypes out, but as far as full commercial scale facilities using floating technology, there's currently none deployed. But to your point, yes, that is a possibility that future sites may be in deep water where foundation technology isn't adequate, so there'd be floating technology. So that's certainly a possibility. But I don't necessarily see some of the closer inshore sites not being developed as a result of that. I almost see it more depending on what the demand is from the states, just more of supplementing what's done in the inshore waters.
Mr. Belavance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Brian, for your presentation. My question revolves around the fisheries liaison position and then the fisheries communication plan. I'm just curious if you could elaborate on the timeline of when that position would or should be filled, and what role that person would have in mitigation and some of the things we've heard around the table today.
Sure. Obviously, the lease hasn't been executed yet, so I would imagine not too long after the lease is executed and before we receive any plans for site assessment surveys or even construction or any type of survey on the water would be that window of when a fishery liaison and a fishery communications plan would be developed. As far as the lease itself doesn't stipulate anything about the specific roles and responsibilities, we refer to our communication guidance document, the socioeconomic guidance document that kind of lays out a lot of what we talked about in the best management practices workshops about what the roles and responsibilities of fishery liaisons and fisheries representatives. As you know, there's two parts to that, you know, could be, but we don't stipulate what their specific roles and responsibilities need to be.
Any other questions from the council? Mr. Alexander.
Thank you, Brian, for the presentation. On the, you mentioned that the transceivers for your array were VIMCO. Those are compatible with the present studies that are going on with sturgeon along the coast, right?
Yeah, this is the standard kit, you know, for all these acoustic arrays. So the inshore stuff as well as these new offshore. The only thing that is different is a lot of these have the acoustic release, you know, so they're fully submerged. There's no surface expression of them whatsoever. That technology has really helped out a lot for some of these deeper water deployments. But it's the same. Otherwise, it's the same stuff that's used inshore.
Now, do you have a plan to share that data with all these researchers?
It's a requirement in our contracts that we share via the Atlantic Cooperative Telemetry Network, the ACT network for short, as well as we actually have a meeting with the Mid-Atlantic Telemetry or Tracking Observation, MATOS, I'm getting my acronyms mixed up, but Observation System in February. And we'll be presenting on, you know, that data so far. So yes, that data will be made available.
Okay. And I noticed your presentation slightly different than the one we were supplied prior to the meeting. So we'll get the updated one. I kind of want to share this with our sturgeon.
Oh, you know what happened is what the site, these maps were probably not a wise idea, but they were animations. So they showed up as one slide in the printout, and I should probably change that in the future.
PowerPoint presentation then?
So yeah, I can send you these actual JPEGs. So the presentation itself is the same, but I will send you the individual site locations.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go to the audience. Who's that in the back there? Oh, Ms. Brady.
Bonnie Brady, Long Island Commercial Fishing Association. Dr. Pierce, you spoke about some of the effects of electromagnetic frequency on elasmobranches, et cetera. I sent a package of about 15 documents, some scientific studies, others, stuff Brian's got actually, to Tom Neese so that he can distribute that to all of you via WeTransfer Link site, which is a safe site so you can download all of these various studies to look at the biological responses to pile driving, jet plowing, and then juicing the ocean floor. This is a very good person, and this is an entirely corrupt process. We have been fighting BOEM because they have decided to plant a spot, lay their claim, and then worry about the effects afterward. We have talked to them, as Mr. Reed spoke of, regarding TOES, willing to sign off on personal financial information to show specifically on which days correspond our lines of our TOES to fish returns that show exactly how much money we made from a fishing trip in that year. It's not going anywhere. This is a very huge concern specifically for Long Island because apparently LIPA and PSE&G are going to sign off on the Cox's Ledge project today for a $740 million facility with 90 megawatts of power that actually can only possibly be 75 because of where they put it. They won't be able to get as much juice. Could they put them further? Great. But yes, they can. And you know this, but if they do, they don't get as much juice back from them, and so they don't make as much profit, so they don't make them attractive. Statoil specifically has that floating turbine technology, which I had looked into. But until there is a way to specifically and truthfully address the traditional historic stakeholders in this process so that their livelihoods don't go by the wayside for the next best thing. We're screwed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smallwoods.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smallwoods, Fisheries Survival Fund. Hi, Brian. The question I have is, over the last 10 years, I've been attending WIN meetings since 1996, and over the last 10 years, I've suggested to BOEM that they establish a research set-aside fund very similar to what we've done in the scallop fishery, where the developers and investors, it could be based on the rents or what have you, contribute to a fund that's managed by somebody other than the stakeholder. In this case, most of the long-term monitoring issues to me are marine living resource. I would think it would fall under the Northeast Science Center's cooperative fisheries program, and they could develop a process similar to what we have in the council process, where stakeholders could contribute research ideas, scientists contribute research ideas, and that the program would be well-funded into the future. What would it take to establish such a process in this scenario?
Thanks, Ron, and I definitely appreciate your comments in that regard. Actually, our guidance on pre-construction surveys, well, and you'll see the same guidance or similar language in our post-construction surveys guidance, is that if appropriate, that they could pool resources, developers can pool resources to really put together a more region-wide monitoring program as appropriate. So right now it is in our guidance to developers to consider that. I think it would be great if the industry could come to them and say, look, you know, we have these ideas, and you know, get the different lessees in the area that you have an interest to agree. I don't necessarily see BOEM imposing a fund that all the developers must contribute to. I mean, it could, but I think there needs to be a lot more, I think more groundwork from directly from the fishing industry or the councils to the developers to say, hey, this is a good idea, and it would be great if they would then propose that in their construction and operations plan. So that's my recommendation going forward.
And a couple of quick questions. How are these VEMCO receivers not going to be dredged up?
Hopefully by placing them well. This is a New York State University at Stony Brook. I think they have some experience with these trawlable moorings, supposedly. They said they've had good luck in some of the – you can see some of their inshore arrays that are currently there. Obviously, I can see if I can point to that. It's kind of weak. But anyway, you see them coming off of Long Island there. Those are obviously in trawled areas. So they say they've done a good job of developing a mooring that will stay put.
So. Yeah, they're trawl-proof but not dredge-proof. just one last question is that – you read the New York blueprint for their offshore wind. They're talking about 31 gigabytes of power production. So this site here is 700 megawatts. So we're talking 50 times the area, and their projected plan covers things like the Hudson Canyon access, the Elephant Trunk access area. I mean, at this stage, is BOEM responding to their blueprint?
No, at this stage... But we're not responding. I mean, they have no authority in federal waters except, you know, really via the Coastal Zone Management Act. They have their goals and their targets of, I think, how much renewable energy they want to bring. But I don't think they've necessarily said – they have what they call their planning area, the area that I think they see and they're trying to vet through a lot of environmental studies to try to identify areas that – potentially additional facilities could go, but I don't think they're necessarily, even though that study area encompasses a lot of high-value fishing areas, I don't think they're proposing any activities in those areas right
Thank
now,
you.
At least.
Yeah.
Mr. Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Williamson, fishery liaison for Dong Energy's Bay State Wind lease area and the New Jersey Ocean Wind lease area. It's a new position that's been created for this company. I've been on the job now for about 7 months and developing a fishery communications plan, and it's turning out to be a real challenge. So I'll be talking to members of this community off and on now for the next several years in developing that plan. To Mr. Reed's concern that was expressed a little while ago about the interaction with the survey vessels, Eric, there were two companies conducting surveys in the area south of Martha's Vineyard this last summer, August through October. One of them was Dong Energy's. We're working for Dong Energy. We had an experienced fisherman on the vessel for the full 45 days of the two survey legs, Steve Welch from Scituate, Massachusetts, someone who had fished in that area regularly for several years. And his job specifically was to interact with any fishing effort that was going on in the area. I'm not aware that there was any serious interactions with trawl vessels that were working the area, but it was a matter of following the rules of the road. And in most cases, the survey vessel opted to give way to the fishing vessels rather than make issue on anything, because there was certainly the flexibility for the survey vessel to do that. The intent of having a fisherman on board was so that the communications were between the fisherman to fisherman, and that the survey vessel was showing some respect for the fishing that was going on in the area. There's also concern with the interaction with fixed gear and potential for entanglement that way, and we managed to avoid that entirely. So I hope that if there'll be more work in the future, the whole purpose of the fishery communication plan is to create the conditions for a good neighbor relationship between the two industries, and that if there are potentials for interactions, that we'll work them out ahead of time.
Thank you. Anybody else in the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. Mr. Bullard.
Brian, thank you once again for appearing before the council. I continue to believe that your appearances here are extremely valuable, because I think in the council you get an opportunity to receive efficiently a broad spectrum of fishing industry experience that you can make use of, and I think that is always a good thing, and more and frequent interchange results in better plans. I also want to thank you and Boehm for receiving NOAA Fisheries comments and making changes, because listening to comments without acting on them isn't as effective as listening to comments and taking them seriously and making changes. I want to second Ron Smolowitz's suggestions that as Boehm enters the relatively new field of offshore renewable energy, it's a tremendous opportunity to pioneer new ways of doing business. And whether it's finding ways to fund
research, which will lead to you know, sustainable operations, or to fund marine spatial planning, which I think in the case of Block Island, albeit in state waters, one of the first in the water renewable energy, provided the kind of conversations that led to accommodation and happy outcomes between the industry and between both industries of offshore wind and fishing that you want to strive for. I think that kind of idea, I don't think it really happens voluntarily. At least in my experience, it doesn't tend to happen voluntarily. If it's a requirement that's leveled on everybody, and everybody knows that going in, good things can happen. The final point I want to make is that as people look at proposals, lease areas, and things like this, there is a tendency, it's human nature, to compare something new, a wind energy area, against the status quo. And as I say, it's human nature. But this council knows the marine environment, especially right now, is anything but a status environment. It is changing rapidly. Temperatures changing, pH is changing, all kinds of things are changing. And reliance on fossil fuels, I don't think, is the fishing industry's friend. And shifting over to renewable energy is something that needs to happen, that with BOEM's leadership is happening, and needs to happen quickly. So comparison to status quo it's a fantasy. It's not a status environment. It is not a status environment. You look, and the guy to my right is the person who ought to speak about this, but whether you're looking at Greenland or the Arctic or the Antarctic, anywhere you want to look, it is happening now. It's going to have and is having a huge impact, and we don't have the luxury of saying, well, let's wait, you know, 20 years until we can invent this or that. We need to act now, and fishermen out there are seeing it in many ways. The scallop industry is seeing it. Every industry is seeing it. So, BOEM, you're on the front lines of fighting this battle. So, Brian, thanks for being here. As often as you are, I'm just saying, you're always welcome. The more often, the better. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you very much, and that concludes that part of the agenda. We're going to move on to the next section, Dr. Hare, Cooperative Research Review, as well as he's going to give the Science Center report that was due yesterday. Dr. Hare.
John Hare, Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Is there any preference on the order that I go?
You decide.
Okay, so we'll do the Science Center report.